Before we get started, I would like to bring your attention to the next Americano Live event. The last one was a huge success, and we anticipate this one will be as big, if not bigger, to get all Trumpy about it. It's Americano Live's Trump's First 100 Days. I will be hosting it, and I will be joined by the great Lionel Shriver. We will be talking about all things Trump. There's a hell of a lot to cover, but we'll do our best to cover the lot. Do join us. It's at the Emanuel Centre on Wednesday, the 30th of April. And the discussion, according to the blurb here, the discussion starts at 7:30 p.m. Book your tickets at spectator.co.uk/Shriver, which is spelt S-H-R-I-V-E-R, as I'm sure you already knew. Please come.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor. On this week's podcast, we ask, is there a moral vacuum at the heart of Starmerism? Is the Church of England committing a sin with the misuse of its buildings? And does Clandon Park's restoration set a terrible new precedent for future projects carried out by the National Trust?
In the cover piece for the magazine this week, our editor Michael Gove writes about the cruel ideology of Starmerism. The Prime Minister, he writes, needs a philosophy, he needs principles, and he needs an ideology. Without one, the vacuum at the heart of Labour will be quickly filled by His Majesty's Treasury. Whether reducing winter fuel allowance or cutting disability benefits, it's becoming clear that policy set solely by Treasury mandarins affects the poorest. How much of a problem is this for Starmer, and have we entered the era of cruel Labour? Michael joined the podcast earlier to discuss, along with John McTiernan, former political secretary to Tony Blair. I started by asking Michael how much the Prime Minister compares to his idol, Clement Attlee.
I think that there is one very valid point of comparison, which is that Keir Starmer has invoked Clement Attlee's quiet patriotism and his role as a co-architect of NATO in order to remind people that Labour Prime Ministers can be patriots and can be strong on defence, and he deserves credit for that. However, there is a distinction, I think, between Clement Attlee's Labour and Keir Starmer's Labour. That Clement Attlee, while he was quiet, modest, and eschewed flamboyance, rather like Starmer, had an ideology. There was a clear view suffusing the post-war Labour government of what building a new Jerusalem should mean. The conclusion that I've drawn, particularly after last week's spring statement, is that there is no ideological anchor keeping the Starmer government in the right place, or indeed in any place, that there is in the heart of Starmer's number 10, confusion and cacophony rather than purpose and definition. And into that vacuum, I fear, has stepped the Treasury. Their fingerprints are all over the spring statement, not those of Rachel Reeves as a political chancellor, but those of the deep Treasury, as it were, who see the purpose of any fiscal event as putting manners on government departments and balancing the books. And you can see that in the way in which the welfare reforms that were put in are not so much reforms as an exercise in saving money and hitting the poorest hardest.
So when you say that you fear that the Treasury is stepping into this place, why is that such a cause of concern?
Well, in my experience, both in government and observing it from outside, the Treasury has power, it has some of the best civil servants in government, but it also has its own, if not ideology, certainly set of revealed preferences. And they are to balance the books at all costs, to bear down, or at least to control public spending in order to calm the markets, rather than thinking about growth or social justice or an industrial strategy or any other value which a progressive politician of whichever party might wish to see delivered. And you need strong chancellors with an ideology, whether that is Nigel Lawson or Gordon Brown, in order to utilise the resources of the Treasury for good. And my concern is that Rachel Reeves, who I have no doubt is a sincere and generous-hearted individual has allowed herself to be captured by the orthodoxy, much as Philip Snowden was, the Labour Chancellor between 29 and 31, who imposed austerity and then found that he split the Labour Party.
John, what do you make of Michael's argument in the magazine this week that Starmer lacks a clear philosophy, which is creating a moral vacuum at the heart of government?
There's so many excellent thoughts, both in the article and in what Michael's just been saying. I'll try and respond to a few of them and then let's get into the conversation. For me, the invocation of Attlee is interesting and it's important because Attlee was a great war leader, and that's one of the things that gave the country confidence that there was a Labour patriotism. And I think that is a very important element of it. And Attlee had a humility as well, and that kind of patriotic humility came out amazingly when, you know, on the death of Churchill, it was Attlee who said he was indeed the greatest Englishman of all. Now, that is a kind of ennobling sentiment because it's saying somebody from the Labour side saying this about a huge figure on the Tory side. That to me is a measure of the Attlee and the greatness. His modesty is part of that, but he left a legacy. You know, the NHS still drives our politics, our national politics. What other institutions from the 1940s, apart from the one that Michael talked about, NATO, do the same driving of our politics? And that's the thing which I think here is exemplary on. He is a great international leader, he looks comfortable there. He's obviously campaigned internationally on the death penalty, but he looks comfortable on the international stage, I think, because he has, and Michael alludes to this, he has an ideology developed in opposition, not by him, not by the team around the leader in the leader's office, but actually developed by David Lammy, progressive realism. And in one sense, you can dismiss it as a catchphrase, but realism is the way in which every government has to face the task it has, whether internationally or here. You know, when we have to increase defence spending, I don't think Keir hesitated for one second about cutting aid and putting it in defence spending, because he understood intuitively that the public understand, the voters get, the hard power, soft power, two sides of the same coin. So you see an instinctive movement in the security and defence agenda, but there is an ideology, progressive realism. We have to be realistic, as we do with President Trump and his actions. We have to be progressive in the outcomes that we seek to achieve in all of the things we have. And that, I think, is the really powerful critique in Michael's cover piece. What is the domestic reform agenda? Well, we can see there's reform attempts in various areas. What are the principles that bind it together? We know Margaret Thatcher's policy unit asked the question, is there a more market-oriented way to solve this problem? We know that the Tony Blair's policy unit asked, you know, what matters is what works. So that, does this work? I don't care about the ideology it comes from. But there is a different set of principles in welfare reform, in health reform, in education reform, in justice reform, prison reform. So you get all across the board. And I think this is the issue that unanchors Labour domestically and raises the question, what are they doing and why? Because I think, I'll just finish on this observation. For me, why is the hardest question in politics? So why are you cutting the benefit payments to disabled people? It cannot be because of your creepy moralistic campaign, because people with disabilities get the money for the cost of disabilities in work or out of work. There's nothing moral about taking £4,500 away from nearly a million people. There's definitely an impact to that. There's no doubt why the government didn't publish an impact assessment. But the question they have not yet answered, any of them, ministers, cabinet members, prime minister, the chancellor, is why are you taking £4,500 a year off nearly a million people? And until you can answer why, you can't even start to have an ideology or reform principle.
Hmm. Michael, what do you make of that? That Keir Starmer is a progressive realist.
I find myself very much in agreement with John. I wouldn't have expected before Keir Starmer was elected. Indeed, I wouldn't have expected on the basis of his first few months in office to acknowledge that on the international stage, diplomatically and in terms of defence, that Keir Starmer is proving to be a good prime minister. It's not easy for me to acknowledge that, but I do believe that the restraint overall that he's shown in the face of provocation from the United States and the attempts that he's made in order to improve Britain's security infrastructure, they deserve credit. But I also agree, and this is very much my argument in this week's issue, that domestically, it's a mess. There are individual changes that are being made. Probably won't surprise people to know that I'm broadly sympathetic to the efforts being made by Wes Streeting in health to increase autonomy, contestability, and to have sharper accountability. That's broadly in line with the type of reform that the coalition under David Cameron believed in, and indeed that mid to late stage Tony Blair enacted. But elsewhere, I see confusion and incoherence, and that confusion and incoherence has led, I fear, to cruelty in the way that John characterises it. You can reform welfare. You should reform welfare in order to sharpen incentives to work and to support people into the labour market. But one of the things that has happened here in order to meet an arbitrary Treasury target is that support has been taken away from people who have difficulty washing, dressing and cooking for themselves.
Well, Michael, on the point about cruelty, you make the bold point in your piece where you say that if a Conservative government had pursued some of the measures that Labour is now pursuing, then you would have resigned from that government. What would you say to critics of the 14 years of Tory government who might compare Labour's measures now with the austerity period that we saw, particularly in the coalition years? Do you think those comparisons would be unfair at this point?
No, I can completely understand why those comparisons are made. But one of the things during coalition years was there was a determined effort, not always successful, but a determined effort to ensure that if you looked at the distribution of pain, that it was spread across groups, classes and sections of society. So George Osborne's claim, we are all in this together, oft derided, actually guided our thinking. Now, again, to be fair, it was the case that the Liberal Democrats saw it as part of their mission to ensure that a necessary correction in the public finances was accompanied by sensitivity towards the poorest. But it was the case that at the same time as we were reducing public expenditure in a variety of areas, we were introducing changes like the pupil premium that saw more money in the education system go to the very poorest. And it was also the case that Ian Duncan-Smith was explicit when he was creating universal credit, that this was a means of ensuring that work was always incentivized, individuals' income was taken account of, and there would be support there for the most disabled. And again, you know, without wanting to go into biography, as it were, David Cameron would never have countenanced changes to the welfare system that hit the disabled hardest.
The thing that I take from decades of experience of working in government, working on policy, opposing policy, working in local government, the central government, working in governments abroad, is a single thing that I take, which is that the best reforms are by and large bipartisan. So Grant maintains status for schools, leads from Ken Baker through to Michael and beyond into academies. But in the middle of that, there was Labour was behind the academies. The same thing is true. Welfare to work policy has been broadly consistent since Peter Lilly's period. You know, you need to give people some help, some people some hassle, and help and hassle get people into work. On supporting the poorest families, it goes back to Sir Keith Joseph, the insight, the correct insight, that some people cannot sell their labour at a price appropriate to maintain their families in dignity and out of poverty. And the government has to have a role in this. Family income supplement became family credit, became a tax credit, became universal credit. There's a continuity of policy intention there to protect families from poverty. And probably Peter Lilly had the most important insight about welfare changes, welfare reforms, is the thing to do is not take a penny from existing claimants. Change the benefits for people who receive it in the future. And that's why Peter Lilly had 5 years of successful Secretary of State, which I went into to office supporting Harriet Harman when she became the DWP Secretary of State. And his principle was a very, very sensible one. Don't take money away from people who currently have it. But what is Labour's defining interventions in welfare reform? To take winter fuel payments from 10 million people, each of whom have at least four relatives. So you're actually putting 40 million people offside. And you are what you do. Your social being is your actions, not the intent that you speak. And now this massive package of not reforms, but cuts which are cuts, straightforward cuts in cash. You know, we are from a small number of people, a million people. It's a mantra inside DWP that to save £1 billion, you have to take £1,000 from a million people. And most people listening to this podcast will know that they'd miss £1,000. Labour has trebled down on that and is taking £4,500 from a million people. I don't know anybody personally who wouldn't miss £5,000 a year. It's a huge hit. And these are people on the lowest incomes and in difficult situation. It's hard to disagree with Michael that confusion and incoherence in reform principles is leading to cruelty. And you can see Labour's poll numbers are dropping like a stone at the moment. And I think in the end, in politics, the two main parties, the two great parties of British politics over the last century, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, have a brand identity. And the confusion in politics comes when you don't do you don't do the thing that stands for who you are. So, you know, the great football chant, who are you? Who are you? Well, who are Labour when they think that they can take, in terms of Labour values, they can take £4,500 a year away from a million people?
Michael, just finally, do you think there's any chance that Labour may end up reneging on these reforms?
Well, I think that they're committed in the tackle, as it were. But I do know and understand from people who have been in the civil service that within the Department of Work and Pensions, there is a desire to, rescue might be too strong a word, but reset some of these changes in order to have a more thoughtful approach and a greater level of meaningful support and incentivization for people to get into work. I hope that policy does move in that direction.
And do you think that these reforms and these plans for welfare changes, spending cuts, are they going to cause a political headache for Keir Starmer down the line within his own party? I mean, for a lot of backbench MPs, a lot of people have just been elected for the first time. I mean, a lot of them, I imagine, will be thinking, this is not what I was elected for as a Labour MP, to cut spending and welfare in this way.
I'm sure there will be. I hear profound disquiet, less audible disquiet than one might expect. And I think that that's partly because, you know, after 14 years in opposition, the Parliamentary Labour Party wants to show a degree of solidarity and give secretaries of state the benefit of the doubt. I completely understand that. But I think one of the things that was difficult was people who were prepared to accept the overall moral argument for cutting welfare in order to incentivise work were given pause for thought immediately before the spring statement, when the figures were adjusted, extra money was lopped off the budget, and it looked less like, as I put it, keyhole surgery in order to improve access to the labour market, and more like the extraction of a pound of flesh with some extra butchery required. But Liz Kendall, I do believe, wants ultimately to get to the right outcome, and it will be interesting to see if she can take both the department and the Treasury and the Parliamentary Labour Party with her.
John and Michael, thank you very much for joining.
Lara, what else do you enjoy in the magazine this week?
I love golden syrup, I love dumplings, and I love Olivia Potts's writing. So I think I was always going to like her recipe for golden syrup dumplings. She says there's absolutely no subtlety here. This is just extreme comfort with soft, pillowy clouds, sticky exteriors, and a glossy golden sauce. And she said when you've eaten these dumplings, you feel like you could lead a revolution or fight a bear. So I'm going for that one. What about you?
The piece I particularly love from the magazine this week is by the author Lawrence Osborne. He lives in Bangkok, and which meant that he lived through these terrible earthquakes that, of course, hit Bangkok and Burma at the end of last week. And he had to be evacuated from his high-rise apartment very, very quickly. He then snuck back in to go and rescue his small dog. And he tells the tale in a very exciting way in the magazine this week in his letter from Bangkok. And he's kindly recorded an out loud version of his piece. And we can hear an extract from that now.
Still barefoot, I ignored the protests of the staff and went into the abandoned lobby where chunks of plaster lay all over the floor. I began to climb my way back to my apartment up the same staircase by which I had descended. But now I was alone, and I was probably alone in the whole building. It was the most Balladian moment of the whole day. Fear of death, of being buried under masonry. I found whiskey cowering in my bathroom. I scooped him up and re-emerged into the landings where the immense walls were still subtly moving. Over the years, I've often heard that the building is haunted by all the people who have died in it peacefully. It seemed realistic now. Rejoining in the crowd, I was struck by how calm and good-humoured it was, a Thai resilience smoothly working under the surface. Moreover, I could see that my building, which I take for granted, is in fact a society in miniature. Sentimentally, you could say that only cosmic near-misses make this obvious to the isolated and self-obsessed tenant. In a city of more than 11 million, only one building collapsed entirely. A new, supposedly earthquake-resistant tower in Chatuchuk, built by a Chinese company sinisterly named China Railway No. 10 in cooperation with the Thai government. Needless to say, it disintegrated in seconds, killing dozens. The company was later determined to have used substandard steel. Four Chinese nationals were arrested for entering the site to retrieve incriminating documents. Well, I heard one of my co-tenants say in the street, so much for the crappy future.
Next up, has the Church of England compromised the sacred nature of its buildings? From yoga classes to drag shows and even a helter-skelter, the Reverend Dr. Jamie Franklin, host of the podcast Irreverent and author of the book The Great Return, writes in the magazine this week about what he argues is the Church of England's tragic misuse of its sacred spaces. And perhaps in many ways, this new reality for the church is symptomatic of an issue with the leadership. So what needs to change? Writing the diary for the magazine, the journalist Quentin Letts provides his own manifesto for the next Archbishop of Canterbury. Quentin, whose new book Nunc is out now, joined the podcast alongside Jamie, and I started by asking Jamie about the church's strange relationship with aesthetics and when he first noticed the trend.
I found faith myself in an evangelical context. Actually, I went to churches which met in school halls, and you know, I was baptized in a school swimming pool and all this kind of thing. I was actually drawn to the Church of England because of the aesthetic, what I see now as Catholic nature of the church. And it was the beauty and the majesty and the wonder of my local cathedral and of the medieval parishes that I saw around me. And I really came to the view that the sort of evangelical paradigm that I was part of was actually really lacking something. So for me, it was the aesthetic that actually drew me in originally and set me on this path where now I'm actually a high church Anglo-Catholic priest in the Church of England. So it's been a shame for me to see the way that the Church of England has not only disregarded the aesthetic of these buildings, but has actually in some ways misused them, and in many ways farcically so. In the magazine, I talk about these examples, many of which will be familiar to listeners, but you know, the 55-foot helter-skelter in the nave at Norwich, miniature golf in the nave at Rochester Cathedral, lunar installations, planetary displays, gin production in Blackburn Cathedral, silent discos all over the country, you know, booze flowing, goodness knows what else going on, you know. Canterbury Cathedral hosts these things, you know, just near the place where Thomas à Becket was martyred. It's sacrilegious, really, and it's a great misuse of this wonderful inheritance that we have, this wonderful aesthetic inheritance and legacy that we have as the Church of England.
I went to one of those planetary displays. It was like a Sonne Lumière at Hereford Cathedral. It was very beautiful, actually. It was really good and very spiritually uplifting. So I would agree that some of the events, like the crazy golf, absurd. But some of them actually can work. And there's a reason, though, that cathedrals are one of the few success stories of the Church of England recently, and that is that there is the beauty of the service, of the liturgy, of the canticles, like the Nunc Dimittis. I've written a book called Nunc, I should say. But there is a reason for that. The beauty of the service does draw people in. But the reason that the progressives of the 1960s, 70s, 80s were so opposed to beauty is that beauty is hierarchical. And it offended their sense of egalitarianism, because beauty is not achievable by everybody. You know, wonderful music cannot be achieved by people like me. You need to have somebody who's a good singer. And therefore, it's not fair, the egalitarians would say. And that is the philosophical problem that they have with beauty.
Jamie, would you agree with that as a philosophy? And is that something which has been adopted by leaders in the Church of England nowadays.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think that's probably what was going on, you know, during the 1960s with the Vatican II liturgical reforms as well. I think that's definitely true. To my mind, I think there's the other component here would be the secularization of the West in general, but of the Church as part of that. And I think there's a connection between a kind of secularized mindset and the downplaying of beauty. You know, in the medieval period, for example, why did people go to such lengths to build cathedrals? These enormous expense and technical skill was needed for these things. Why did they do that? It was because they believed that in some sense these things were actually not only that they spoke of the transcendent realm, but they're actually in some sense a conduit for it. You know, they're a sort of an arena for the manifestation of the divine in that sense. And I think when you stop really believing that the divine can actually manifest itself in the world in some way, particularly through the material world, you start to downplay the importance of sacred space and time. And I think that's another aspect to it. I think the other aspect, which is an obvious thing to say, is there's a sort of crass, pragmatic utilitarianism in all of this. You know, it's often just as silent discos and so on. They're often justified as, well, you know, this is a really good way to reach people. You know, people will start coming to our services if we do this, when in fact, cathedrals a lot of the time are struggling for money, as a parish church is, and they put these things on because they are trying to utilize their buildings in order to make a profit. So I think there's a few things going on.
Quentin, you've written a lovely diary in the magazine this week, and in it you propose your own manifesto for the next Archbishop of Canterbury. What are your suggestions, and would you like to see an archbishop who cares about aesthetics?
Oh, yeah, I would. I actually didn't include that in it. It was a very good thought. I should have had more space.
My apologies.
One of my things is get rid of mitres, because I think mitres make bishops look complete fools. But I've got a couple more serious points. One is stop this talk. The Church of England, I wish the Church of England hierarchy would understand that there is a reason that not many people buy The Guardian. Anyway, I would get rid of all this talk about reparations. Millions of pounds have been spent in reparations on slavery, because it is really demoralising people in the parishes, and we've had people come into our local church. Nobody's come in saying, yippee, I really want to join your church because they say these things about reparations. In fact, we've had people refusing to add to the collection because they think the money's going to be wasted. I would get rid of 75% of sermons. Sermons are, a large majority of them, I think, are inept and put people off. And a lot of them are very political as well. And so I would scrap that. I'd have that as a sales point. Say about services, no sermon. I think more people would come along to them. And I would also say that I'd like the new Archbishop, he or she, to stop apologising. Be proud of Christianity. And stop this, you know, sort of trust people. And don't be so suspicious of people. Therefore, stop the focus on safeguarding, which seems to me creates all sorts of suspicions. And also all the money that's wasted and the suspicions that are created by the race advisors. These things are incredibly off-putting to what I'd say normal churchgoers. And just to go back, if you mentioned aesthetics can be tremendously comforting actually to people who are in trouble. And in my novel, it starts with somebody who's been told that they've got terminal cancer. They drop in, they've had a few drinks at the wine bar, they drop into the local cathedral, this man, and he hears the Nunc Dimittis being sung beautifully, and it transports him, and his mind runs, and he then thinks about first century BC Jerusalem with and what that was like. But the sound of really good music can be a complete balm to a troubled soul.
Quentin, just picking up on one of the many points, excellent points you made there, but surely when it comes to the safeguarding, you said that Church of England leaders shouldn't worry so much about safeguarding, but it hasn't, you know, hasn't this current predicament that the Church of England's got itself into, and the downfall of Justin Welby could not be argued precisely because of a failure to take safeguarding seriously.
No, exactly the opposite. He was hoist by his own petard. He's created this complete sort of phalanx, this network of secular Stasi, so to speak, these safeguarding people, and they've done for him because he wasn't, he hadn't been completely spotless himself on reporting people. So I think if he hadn't put such a premium on these people in the past, then they wouldn't have been able to get rid of him.
Jamie, you mentioned earlier trying to use these churches as spaces to attract people, but you seem to take issue with some of the choices being made. But is it not better to have a church filled with people for whatever reason than an empty church?
No, I don't think so. I can think of all sorts of reasons that it would not be good to open the church for people to be coming in. No, the church is here to... Churches exist to worship God, to be a place where Christians gather to worship God, to be taught the faith and to be sent out into the world. That's the primary purpose of churches. If churches lose sight of that purpose, then they really are just venues for, you know, any particular purpose. And as a priest in the church, I don't want to see our churches be reduced to the status of concert venues and venues for all sorts of other things. So I do think the purpose that these spaces are used for matters greatly. And as an Anglo-Catholic priest in the church, I also would place great emphasis upon the fact that the Blessed Sacrament is reserved in many churches, and people go there to be in the presence of holiness, to be in a place of sanctity, beauty, and a sense of the presence of God. And it's undeniable in my view that when churches are used in these ways, that it dilutes that sense of sanctity and peace and tranquility.
Church, capital C, doesn't just happen in churches, small c, it happens elsewhere. So I'd like to see a parson in every pub. So I'd stop sending the clergy off on conferences and on continual professional development. Goodness me, they waste a lot of time and money on that. And I'd send them down to the local boozer with a tenner in their pocket and get them to mix with the public, with the parish much more. I've spoken to a couple of priests before I came on here and said, what do you think? And one said that it really be helpful if the next archbishop has had a parish experience. So to be a parochial type of archbishop rather than to be a manager. Not this constant sort of common purpose management that goes on. And the other thing is, I'd say, another one said, don't see tradition as a dirty word. And too much of the top clergy of the last few decades have absolutely shriveled away from the idea of tradition. Tradition, again, is tremendously comforting.
I really agree with what Quentin's just said, but particularly that first point. I think this about bishops in general. You know, as a clergyman myself, what we're looking for is leadership. It's really hard to see how people who have not succeeded in leading a parish well, you know, ideally many parishes well, can help people who are trying to lead parishes into growth and life and flourishing. It seems somewhat absurd to have somebody who's never done that in a position of such responsibility as a diocesan bishop or even the archbishop. So I really agree with what Quentin says there. We really need somebody who knows how to engage people with the faith, ordinary people, and who's not so cut off from your average parishioner that they really have no idea. And I think that that is an area where Justin Welby was critically lacking, and unfortunately many others are as well. I'd just like to say also about the comment Quentin made earlier about sermons. I'm a big fan of sermons, but as long as they're good. So
yeah.
So I agree with you. I agree with you, Quentin, that there should be fewer bad sermons and that there should be fewer political sermons.
Well, I have to tell you, my wife is a church organist, and so she hears more bad sermons than the rest of us. And she was playing, I hasten to say, she was playing an away match at a church that shall not be named. And a slightly scruffy specimen got up into the pulpit and started telling this congregation of about 50 relatively blameless souls, as I think they were, that unless they denounced and renounced the Balfour Declaration, they were not going to go to heaven. And it was completely political. And it was total rot. And there's quite a lot of that sort of thing going on.
Yes.
After the 2016 referendum, we had a bishop's letter basically telling us what wicked souls we were to have voted Brexit. So this sort of stuff just has to stop. It'd be much better if just don't get them into the pulpit and just rely on the liturgy, a lot of them, although I'm sure your sermons are mustard.
Finally then, Jamie, of course, we've been talking about what Quentin wants to see in the next Archbishop of Canterbury. You are, of course, the host of the very popular Reverent podcast, in which you and your co-hosts, I would think it's fair to say, often pretty critical of the Church of England leadership. So what if you were brought in by the next Archbishop of Canterbury, whoever he or she may be, and asked to give one bit of advice, what would be your main message you would want to give?
I think my main message would be that we have to have confidence in the gospel. We have to have confidence in the Christian faith. We have to have confidence in sharing that message with the world and not allowing ourselves to become a pale imitation of the world. If I could just give an example, this week, Justin Welby was interviewed by Laura Kunzberg, who asked him in that interview, given certain issues in the Church of England, how can the Church of England be said to be reflective of modern Britain? Now, in my opinion, that question should be rejected by any self-respecting archbishop as a fallacy. We are not here to reflect the state of modern Britain. We're here to represent Christianity and the Christian faith. And that fundamental principle is something that I'd like to see the archbishop, the next Archbishop of Canterbury, embrace.
Jamie and Quentin, thank you very much for joining.
And finally, how much of a building can be restored before it becomes a different building entirely? Well, this is what Calvin Poe calls the conundrum of conservation. And he writes in the Arts Lead of the magazine this week as he examines the National Trust's plans for Clandon Park and ponders if the Trust's controversial approach could set a catastrophic precedent for future restorations. The 18th century mansion managed by the National Trust was gutted by a fire in 2015. Guildford Council have approved plans to conserve the bricks and mortar of the building with a modern roof and walkways, but to leave the interior in its half-charred form. The Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings, founded by William Morris, has hailed the plans and argued that a full restoration would amount to a feeble and lifeless forgery. But the Georgian group have dissented with the Trust proposal and argued that the building's merit comes in its original design and not in burnt bricks. To discuss this further, we were joined by the Georgian Group's director, Dr. Anya Lucas, and the architectural historian and writer, Gillian Darley. Anya, to begin with, you're quoted in Calvin's Arts Lead in this week's Spectator, and you say that the architectural distinction of Clandon Park lies in its original design, not in burnt bricks. I wanted to start with, could you outline for our listeners the Georgian group's opposition to the plans a little bit more?
Yes, and I think I should start by saying we're, of course, a friend of the National Trust and can indeed collaborate with the National Trust on projects. But in this particular situation, we are a critical friend of the National Trust. We think they've got it seriously wrong on this particular scheme. And we set out at the planning committee meeting why we think it's wrong. And there are a number of reasons. Firstly, it's this issue of using post-fire significance as the baseline to measure the proposals and the harm. We think that's fundamentally flawed. We think the harm that would derive from this scheme has been seriously underplayed by the National Trust, the applicant, and by officers at Guildford Borough Council. And that harm takes all sorts of forms. It's demolition of surviving fabric. It's the failure to reinstate the original volumes of the spaces. So, for example, the floor plate of the Palladio room. And then it's this really intrusive roof addition, introducing effectively a viewing platform that disrupts the Leone's original design, introduces a cafe, kiosk, lift overruns on the roof line, fundamentally alters the way the building's perceived from the landscape around it. And as I say, Leone's original design intention. And then beyond that, it's this issue of incredibly of a missed opportunity of depriving future generations of the chance to appreciate these extraordinary interiors. So Clandon's quite an austere building externally, but of course it gave way to these extraordinary interiors with exuberant sculptural plasterwork by leading stuccatori of the 18th century. There is evidence to reinstate those. It would be an opportunity to really support at-risk heritage crafts. And then there could be a really fascinating dialogue between past and present in terms of contemporary artistic responses to those interiors. So there's a real opportunity here that's being missed, as well as the sort of cut and dried issue of policy compliance in planning terms.
What's the logic from the National Trust for not reinstating a lot of these elements that you're talking about?
It's a good question. We don't think there is any. It seems to us, as I think Calvin described it, as a meaningless spectacle of a triple height shell in his piece. And we agree, we can't see the logic. The evidence is there to reinstate the interiors. Allers and Morrison, obviously an incredibly distinguished architectural practice, and this type of approach might well be appropriate and interesting in some situations, but Clandon is not that opportunity. It's not the right response here.
Gillian, as an architectural historian, what is your opinion on the plans for Clandon Park? And do you have sympathy with the concerns of Anya and the Georgian group?
Rather little, I think I have to say. I'm on the record. I do have problems with all sorts of philosophical points which come into the matter of truth, balance, and that word sincerity. I was having a look at a rather interesting chapter in Alan Chandler and Michaela Pace's book, which is called The Production of Heritage. And they deal very interestingly with Clandon in a chapter called The Memory of Surfaces. And I'm not representing the SBAB, but I am a former chair of the SBAB. I have been involved. And in many, many cases, I take the William Morris view. There's a wonderful line from a sentence from William Morris, 1879. He just says, "It does indeed seem strange to me people cannot see how the times have changed, that they should insist on these lifeless pieces of reproduction." Well, of course, he's back talking about scraping, Scott and scraping. But the Chandler and Pace book talks about sort of generically a view of repair and restoration we have to call it, which is essentially Villiers-le-Duc's attitude. And I find it interesting in your architecture critic, his hyperbolic piece, which I read to prep for this, you know, he uses Villiers-le-Duc and he uses Notre Dame. And of course, the French approach to dealing with these problems is culturally 1,000 miles from where we sit.
Why is that, Gillian? Why do the French and the English have such different attitudes to restoration?
You know, it's a sort of Villiers-le-Duc lived on. And the Scots, some would argue, and I'm sure the Vitsot would hang me up by my toenails for this, but the Scots kind of didn't. The Gothic revival so overstepped the mark, St Albans onwards, just removed any sense of kind of balance. So I'm sort of amazed by the piece in the paper, if I may say so. You know, as I say, it's hyperbolic, unbelievably so. And to instance Japan, we've got another cultural sort of 3 billion miles away, because of course the essence of the Japanese cultural renovation of buildings is the rebuilding over and over and over. We're not talking about the same thing. I mean, what could be more different than Leone, a man who came around 1720 to Guildford? And what was going on in Japan? I'm sorry, I absolutely can't follow his line. So tricky for me. I mean, I think Clandon, it obviously was a terrible disaster. And I mean, I go back to the point at which the SBAB was worrying itself rigid about what to do at a park. And on that occasion, I suppose if we were running a podcast back then, our roles would have been entirely reversed. Yeah. Such is the move and the change and whatever. And Upark is, of course, the epitome of what Anya and the Georgian group are arguing for. I mean, I think there is, of course, there's a middle way. And I was thinking about places that I've looked at quite closely, such as the church in Sheerness, which is absolutely triumphant. I mean, it was a fire damaged building. It was a classical outline. It didn't have the touch of anybody, you know. It's a long way from Palladio, let's say, but it was a very good neoclassical building. And it has turned into, as a reinterpreted, reconsidered, as it were, remembered in a different way.
Anya, can I ask you how much you think this decision about Clandon Park is symptomatic of a broader change in National Trust thinking and what it sees its purpose is in terms of both the preservation and the restoration of buildings? And do you think it sets a somewhat worrying precedent?
Yes, we do think it's a worrying precedent. And, you know, as I say in the piece Calvin wrote, there's a question of what message this is sending. National Trust is obviously a hugely important conservation charity. What message this is going to send, say, to countless building preservation trusts up and down the UK who are embarking on projects of a smaller scale. And of course, as Gillian says, the politics of reconstruction are endlessly fascinating. And what we do to our buildings obviously is symbolic and sends an important message. And here I think we have on the one hand a scheme which is misleading, which is incomplete, which is fundamentally meaningless, versus the opportunity to do something really, really meaningful that, as I say, supports at-risk craft skills, potentially facilitates a much more interesting visitor experience. All the evidence suggests that visitors find really interesting is the dialogue between historic interiors and contemporary responses to them. I happen to be talking to you from Sherburn House in Dorset, which is a Palladian building of almost exactly the same date as Clandon. Until relatively recently, it was one of the country's most high-profile buildings at risk. Structurally, it was in a parlous condition. There was a real risk that historic interiors were going to be lost altogether. It's been the subject of a painstaking restoration, and since it opened last year, 50,000 people have come to see it. There are 120 dedicated volunteers, and what people find really interesting is the historic interiors restored, including the wall paintings, and then the contemporary response to those, you know, in various ways. So we think this scheme is going to harm the historic building, the Grade 1 listed building, but we really don't think it's going to deliver for the National Trust either commercially or in terms of visitor experience. So we think there's an opportunity to do something much more exciting and meaningful.
Gillian, given that you described Calvin's piece as hyperbolic, I imagine you disagree with the idea that plans for Clandon House are setting a bad precedent for the future. Would that be right?
Well, I was a bit astonished because he actually spends a lot of time sort of attacking, you know, the existing planning process and then worrying about the future, you know, the changes that are coming in as well. I mean, it's a very broad brush piece and his targets are multiple. I did read the Georgian Group's comments in 2017, and in a sense, the Georgian Group is reiterating what was said then, obviously against a more refined version. I'm trying to work out what movement is available in all of this. I think, you know, the point about the chimney line might be valid. I don't know, the structures on the roof. But then there's this sort of strange feeling that actually those who support and love Clandon don't really love anything else there. You know, the idea that if you get on the roof, you look out to Guildford and you look at suburban Guildford because it's there, because that's the world we're living in. That's what's, you know, it isn't the day of the man who, you know, pottered down from Westminster in 1720. We've moved on.
I think the reason Calvin references the sort of shortcomings of committee consideration of applications like this is because the chair of the planning committee herself said these were the most complex pair of applications the committee had ever considered. And it was so evident they simply couldn't, the complexity of these applications really went beyond the scope of what the committee was able to do with these 3-minute speaking slots and limited time. And that's why, of course, we feel, you know, these are applications of national significance and they should be debated and aired in front of a planning inspector at a public inquiry. And of course, that's what we've called for. So I don't think he was taking sort of unwarranted pot shots at the planning system or at planning committee. It was just evident to everyone there that evening that these applications needed a different a forum beyond that for proper and full consideration and debate.
Just very finally, Anya, the National Trust has attracted a lot of criticism recently, and we've written about it over the years in The Spectator, that it's moved away from its brief, perhaps in some way, with approaches it's taken on colonial legacies, for example. And do you think that Clandon Park has attracted greater controversy because of this context? Has it been sucked into a kind of wider political argument about the National Trust? Or is it completely separate?
Possibly it has, but of course the Georgian group is not concerned with those debates and is very strictly concerned with what is right for this building, the grade one listed building of the utmost national significance. So whatever other noise there might be, we set that to one side and consider only what is right in heritage asset terms. And as I say, we're a friend of the National Trust, and indeed collaborate with the National Trust on projects. And we're playing the role of critical friend in this instance, because we think they have got it so wrong, that this approach is so misconceived. And just to pick up on that point Gillian made about the world having moved on, it has indeed moved on. But we contend that actually the visitor experience you would achieve by reinstoring the principal historic interiors would be so much more rich and interesting to a wide range of visitors than this scheme, where you have a series of structural steel interventions and walkways and really, as Calvin put it, a meaningless spectacle, and the missed opportunity to support craft skills. That's so much more exciting and would be so much more interesting, we think, to a much wider range of audiences.
Anya and Gillian, thank you very much for joining. And that's everything this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed these discussions, you can pick up a copy of this week's Spectator and you can read all the articles we've discussed, as well as plenty more. And if you do enjoy the podcast, please do click the follow button. You'll then be notified when a new episode is out. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm William Moore. And we hope you'll join us again next week.